And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. I'm Doug Rocky, and I'm talking to you from the rainy, wet state of Illinois. We're kind of drowning down here in central Illinois. We've had rain upon rain upon rain, and more rain coming tonight. Well, you know, this whole song, when we opened it up there with Aretha Franklin, Got Respect For, boy, that goes really good for the people and we and one of the individuals I've got on tonight. Before we get to our guest, Denise, are you there by chance?
I certainly am. I'm with you this week.
Thank you very much. You know, we kind of missed you last week.
We have a couple of announcements to get going here tonight. One of them is the task force report on Guffaw illness that the VA has had. You have about 12 more days, well, really 11 days to make comments on that. So if you Google Guffaw Illness Task Force, it's a VA committee, and there's a full report of, you know, what they're going to be doing, and they're asking for feedback. You can also find it on the Federal Registry. So that's important to know, that if you want to put any feedback, you have a way to comment back and let you be heard. The other two items is the reminder that the VA Research Advisory Committee on Guffaw Illness Research will be meeting on June 17th and 18th in D.C. So that's very important. We need to get as many vets as we can up there. The first day is going to be just really big. We have, let me pull out the agenda here. We have Dr. Henry Hing that will be presenting from Wayne State on the genomic instability in Guffaw illness. We have Durham VA Medical on a Guffaw era cohort and biorepository study report. We have the proteomic models of animal models from Dr. Fiona Crawford down in Tampa, Florida. We have the neuroimaging biomarkers in Guffaw illness, and that's our Georgetown study, which we will have a brand new study published on June 15th from that study group. Then we have a treatment trial with Dr. Julia Galea of VA. Let's see if we have any other guests lined up besides the normal group discussions with VA. So there's some outstanding researchers that will get an update of where they're at. So that's very valuable information. Let's see. There's one bill that we have had spouses working on awfully hard. It's Senate Bill 851, introduced by Senator Sanders. That's the Senate Bill 851. And it seems to be held up on the cost study on it, because I know the spouses and a lot of veterans have been emailing, signing petitions, and Vietnam vets to get the caregiver bill to extend to the pre-9/11. They initiated that program post-9/11 some time back, and so we have a lot of other vets that could utilize that service. So far, no co-sponsors have signed up. We have all the service organizations supporting this, but what seems to be the holdup is the report on how much they project it will cost. And I think we're facing a lot of opposition from the VA to extend that program. So we're going to have a battle there. We still have the National Desert Storm Memorial Bill up there working. So want to get some help on that, call on your congressmen and senators. So those are kind of two of the top dogs that we're tracking. Now, as far as deaths, I just finished up with the deaths for last month. Now I want to name a few because they're significant people. Command Sergeant Major Robert Schooley. These are the older group like we are, a little bit older than us, 76 years old. But a very significant person that put a lot of years in. We have Robert Lee Puckett, died 48 of apparent heart attack. We have some other significant ones. We have Daniel Lynn Parrott, 48, and I don't think it gives the cause of death, but he served in the Navy. We had quite a few Navy veterans dying from the Gulf War during this past month. I don't know what's happened there, but usually have a lot of Army vets. We have Jerry L. Murray. He was 62, served in the Gulf War. We have, I'm just naming a few of them as we recognize them. We have an older one, Paul Morgie. He was a Marine and served in countless instances and a Gulf War vet. James Mitchell of pancreatic cancer. These are all Gulf War veterans. Alvin Del Mercer died, and he was the Chief Master Sergeant from the U.S. Air Force. So the list goes on, and I was scrolling up to get, let's see. Anyway, there's quite a few man sergeant majors that died, and they've put a lot of years in, but then they went to the Gulf War. And we wonder if that was keeping them from living till their 90s, you know. We had a Brandon Weisler, 48 years old, another heart attack, and he was an Army in the Gulf War, served as an MP. Command Sergeant Major, I've already read that one. We had Rose Patrick Rose, 43. I think that was our youngest one this time. Let me scroll on up. We had a 59-year-old, Ronald G. McTeach, and senior airman Susan Leyland, only 58. That's an early age group, really. Mr. Cater, 46 years old, and he served in the Gulf War in the Navy and Army National Guard period of time. Just quite a few, and I have all those on the Gulf War Tabs page on Facebook. And another Chief Master Sergeant that you may know out of Chicago, Eddie Leon Allen, Chief Master Sergeant. So we're losing some of our key people. We're losing young and old. Master Sergeant Arnold Easton Houston was 52. So quite a few that I went through and caught up since I had been on a trip. So I haven't got the total numbers. I'll give you that next radio show with a breakdown on their ages and whether they were Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. But I track those every month and have a page that I listed. If others pick up other obits from our Desert Storm vet, please let me know. My email is dsnurse1@yahoo.com. So that kind of gives you an update today. We did have Memorial Day that I missed the show the day before because I was out traveling.
Well, you know, Denise, one thing I haven't been able to tell you yet, we have lost another member of our team. Master Sergeant Edgar Lovelace of Danville, Illinois. He is a member of the original team that was formed way back in the 70s, and you've met quite a few members of our team. This is an incredible combat medic. He was medical team leader and everything else, and we just found out that he had died overnight.
And how old was he, Doug?
He was 80 years old.
Yeah.
So he had served in, you know, many, many things.
Right. But, well, I'm seeing a lot of those now popping up, and you know, a lot of them served Vietnam and in the Gulf War. So, you know, they had a double whammy. We all know
he
that.
He was Korea and Vietnam and then with us up until into the 80s. So he spent over 30 years. And so another member of our original team, and Rollo and I saw it in the paper today. We haven't found much more other than that. On the, as you already know, on the Gulf War report, as you know, and you've seen the email, I was deliberately blocked from commenting on that, which is not a surprise. They do not want that information that we have to present to them, just like, and again, goes back to the same thing, Colonel John Gingrich, who is no longer Chief of Staff, who wrote the report, and you were involved in that, blocked Bowers Raiders from testifying down in Dallas, Texas, some years ago. So it continues. I'm not sure how we'll get by with that, but we're going to continue to try.
I'm not sure, but we need to get more of the mainstream media onto the Gulf War illness issue. And let me tell you, it's not just us. We have some exposures that were common with the post-9/11.
Oh, same thing.
And well, we are picking them up, aren't we, Doug?
Yeah, we are. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as we go on to this, it's a distinct honor tonight. We have talked about Denny Williams many, many times on our show. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we have Robert Kaler, Bob Kaler, a Chicago-based journalist, nationally syndicated writer. He is the author of Courage Wrong, Strong of the Wound, an incredible book about survival and healing and growth. And, boy, talk about an investigative journalist. I mean, when I talk about respect, I got respect for this guy. Bob, welcome to Warrior Connection.
Hi, Doug. Doug, it's great to be back. Thank you.
How are you, sir?
Well, I'm good. I'm good. I heard you talking about how wet it is down there in Rantoul. It's pretty wet up here in Chicago as well.
Yeah, is the Lake wet. Michigan flowing into your neighborhood yet?
Possibly so. I see little rivers along some of the curbs. So,
did y'all get tornadoes up in that area? Because that's on my trip. I was jumping around tornadoes.
Oh my gosh! Yeah. Well, so far I haven't heard of one headed my way, but yeah, it's been a very strange, wet and cold spring so far.
Yeah, it's, I mean, totally unique. Well, Denise, I mean, you've been reading Bob's column. I know I shared it with you, and I don't never ever met or talked before. Bob, you had a Memorial Day column, and I'm sitting here. It went out on Memorial Day all over the nation.
Uh-huh.
The lever of social action.
Right.
And, I mean, again, you're a voice of peace, an investigator, journalist, a voice of peace. You've written about software illness. You've worked with people. You've helped people get medical care. You've been doing an incredible effort, and you continue to work with it on this, and it's kind of be. I mean, thank you, Bob.
Well. I mean, it's my honor and pleasure. I mean, this is why we know each other, because of Gulf War illness. I read you your words on depleted uranium. I knew a little bit about it, and I went and heard you speak up at U of I in Chicago. This is what 10 years ago now, or something, And I knew that this was something I needed to write about. I have a unique position in the media in that at the time I was an editor at the Tribune Syndicate, Tribune Media Services, and I also had started my own column that they syndicated, but I was not under the control of an editor. I was sort of had this freedom to go and write about stuff that, you know, that I wanted to, and I decided that I would make the column be about things that no one else was writing about, and certainly the Gulf War illness, the, you know, this very strange phenomenon, you know, resulting from the use of depleted uranium munitions, how can this not be written about? And, you know, and yet it's not in the mainstream. And so I've got this little opening, you know, and I do get into the newspapers, so I get to get a little bit of it out there. And but it's people like you that give me, you know, through which the information flows that I feel honored to be able to work with. Anyway, it's great to be back. It's great to be back with you, and to speak to the vets across the country too, who are I find them to be the heroes, especially the ones that are standing for peace, because their voices have the greatest credibility of all, I think.
No, you've been involved in all of this stuff. You were involved in the Winter Warrior stuff and all of this stuff.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I mean, you've been involved for many, many, many years. And, I mean, yourself, I mean, as a journalist, I mean, your book says it all. And I've read the book, and it was an honor to have, and as you have a friend, to have an autographed copy, Courage Grows Strong at the Wound. So you yourself are just like the veteran, has gone through terrific trauma and everything else.
Right.
And as a consequence of that trauma, you do grow strong at the wound. And,
yes.
I mean, your book says it all. And then that's important for all of the veterans, I think, to understand that you can grow and you can develop and you can put into a positive aspect all the things that have happened to us.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the only the only alternative is to collapse in despair, you know. But But that's not, you know, I mean, being human, we do grow. We, you know, when something is severe, when something hurts us, that's where our strength, you know, starts to grow. And so anyway, I mean, all we can do is keep going. And I appreciate so much the work that you're doing to keep going and to keep getting the word out there on the extraordinary horrors of war that do not keep us safe, but certainly cause incredible harm, you know, both to those on our side and those that we're fighting.
I mean, you just did. You did this column right now, and again, you're citing John Pilger.
Yeah.
And people, if you're not aware of John Pilger is an incredible investigative journalist. He is over in England and in Australia, and he's done an incredible amount of work on Gulf War illness and all the health and environmental effects of war. He's written books. He's written columns. He's done television programs. I mean, John is an incredible individual. I have the distinct pleasure to know and to work with also.
Yes.
But, I mean, in there, you're talking about all this stuff. I mean, you're talking about making the moves to peace. What are the health and environmental effects of war? I mean, in your most recent column, you're citing Jody Williams.
Yes.
I've had the opportunity to work with Jody Williams. She is one of the most incredible, incredible Nobel Peace laureates that you'll ever meet in your life. And I think you've met her also, haven't you?
No, I have not personally met her. Maybe that, you know, hopefully in the near future that'll be possible. But
you've been with Kathy, though, right?
Yeah. Oh, you mean Kathy Kelly?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Kathy is a good friend of mine. Yeah, I mean, I've known Kathy for, oh my God, 30 years now. It's way back when I was a reporter at a local paper in Chicago called Lerner Papers, and she was a teacher at a local school in Chicago and starting to, you know, and doing peace work, but, you know, at a very local level. And then both of us, you know, eventually went national.
Well, Kathy's gone international like Jody.
Oh, yeah,
Kathy's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize how many times now? A lot.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, Kathy, I hope Kathy wins it in sometime in the near future. I mean, lately she's taken on drone warfare and gone to jail for protesting and, you know, and stepping across the line and that sort of thing. She's a tremendous inspiration to me, and I know she's going to be marching from I guess Rockford or some. I mean, it's a long, you know, several hundred mile walk in protest to the of drone warfare sometime coming up in the very near future, and she just never stops. And of course, she goes to Afghanistan all the time too.
I think the first time, I met Kathy some time ago, and we got involved working this back about 10, 12, 13 years ago now. Kathy was unable to make a presentation at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and she said, "Doug's right there," you know.
Oh,
and so
okay.
I substituted for her, and that's how I got involved in everything.
Oh, no kidding. That's great.
But anyhow, I know Kathy has been very instrumental. I know in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Balkans, where she has absolutely deliberately and willfully carried medical supplies in to provide
absolutely.
Medical care.
Yeah, before, I mean, way back, you know, when there were still the sanctions going on, she and her, you know, teammates, Voices for Creative Nonviolence, would cross the line into Iraq with medical supplies, you know, violating
the sanctions.
We're talking
about a medical convoy going through war zones to deliver medical supplies.
Yeah.
That's incredible courage.
I mean, courage and, you know, what is, what greater good can you do than bringing medical supplies to children? I mean, oh, my God.
Yeah. But, I mean, you wrote about this. You've got the lever of social action. Again, how do we work for peace, looking at the health and environmental effects of war? You had a column a few weeks ago, again, that I know you got tremendous response from, and that was dealing with all of the stuff, the sexual trauma, the rapes,
yeah.
and all of this stuff within the military.
Right.
I mean, you've been getting involved in the key issues affecting the U.S. military personnel
yeah.
and their families, affecting the people of the world.
Right.
How did you ever get... I mean, how did you ever get involved in all this? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, you and I have talked about it, but it's important for people to understand why a journalist, investigative journalist, would do this when they know that when they do it, their jobs can dry up and blow away like
right,
ours did.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the question is, how can people not get involved? And now there's a tremendous amount of self-censorship in the mainstream media. You know, there's a tremendous amount of one side and another. And when you listen to those in power and you want to continue to have access to those in power, you learn to be very selective about what you pay attention to and what you ignore. And when, I found myself, when I had this column, I found myself in the position of just having a column that I had the freedom to do what I wanted with, as long as I don't use profanity overly much and that sort of thing. I had the freedom to go and start writing about things that seemed to require attention, and that's what I began looking at. I've been an anti-war activist ever since the 1960s when I came, of age politically, and was a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War, but always had tremendous respect for the veterans who did serve, especially the veterans who brought back home with them a message that war is wrong. And so I've always, felt very, very compelled to listen to and report on the things they were talking about, like the Winter Soldier conference back in, when was that, 2009, or I think that was in Washington D.C., where it was mostly Iraq vets that talked about the mess that we had left in, that we were creating in Iraq, that was 4 years ago, that is, of course, has not gone away in the last 4 years. There were vets that took off their medals and returned their medals, surrendered their medals during that conference, and in other ways apologized to the Iraqi people for going over there and and helping to wreck their society and that sort of thing. I mean, war just doesn't work, and nobody knows that better than a vet who's seen it happen, up front and very up close and personal. So,
as you started to do your research many, many years, and you've continued to do it, I mean, you're reaching out, you're gathering documentation, you're gathering evidence, you're talking to individuals who are actually directly involved in the events.
Right.
How much effort does it take? How do you sleep at night and sort through all this stuff? I mean, it's bad enough for those of us that have lived through it and continue to live through it, but you're
yeah.
reaching out there and you're tying not just one or two of us where we're living with one, but you're tying dozens upon dozens of stories together.
Well, it's my honor to be able to do this. I consider myself a peace journalist. It's not a term I invented, but it's a term that there's a lot of room for invention within within, you know, within that concept, what does that mean? And I think one of the things it means to be a peace journalist is that there's more here than just external data. There's a spiritual component to anything that's political, and I mean, there's a moral component. There's a conscience. What is the conscience? But I try to make sure that my conscience remains active as I read the news of the day and reflect on the news of the day, and that's essentially what my column is for the most part. It's looking at the news and reflecting on it, whether it's on depleted uranium, whether it's on nuclear testing, whether it's on sexual assault in the military, whether it's on the prison industrial complex, you know, here at home. In peace journalism means looking at it from as many sides, looking at a piece of news from as many sides as possible. It's not an us versus them. It's not winners and losers. It's not good guys and bad guys. It's the whole human family. And, I start from the idea that we are all one. And, and I truly believe this. And, and I look at the news from that perspective. It's easier to sleep because I'm doing that than it would be if I weren't doing it. I think that, I mean, to get back to try to answer your original question, doing this helps me sleep. If I weren't doing it, I would just, I would wake up screaming in the middle of the night, I think. So.
I mean, you're totally, I mean, again, we're going to go back, let's go to your book a little bit, Courage,
okay.
Strong at the Wound. I mean, you yourself, the soldier and the warrior comes back from war. He's been hit with incredible tragedy and everything else that he can't understand, that can't be justified, can't be explained,
yeah.
Other than we just say, well, this is God's will.
Right.
And, I mean, you yourself had that happen to you, so you can relate and understand, I think,
yeah.
To some degree, the effects of PTSD and war on, as you just said, the incredible social, cultural, moral, but spiritual aspect as it affects a warrior.
Right, right, right. Well, yes, I mean, I lost my wife to pancreatic cancer. It's been 15 years ago now. But, of course, that was an enormous turning point in my life, and at the time I had an 11, well, almost 12-year-old daughter, so I became a single father just as my daughter was entering adolescence, so I had kind of the comedy of errors of raising a teenager, at the same time that I was dealing with, you know, my grief and her grief at losing wife and mom, and so it was a wound, you know, it was perhaps something like a battle scar, and it certainly was a scar running across the entire, you know, length of my life, being able to write about it helped me a great deal. It helped me express my grief. It helped me. It helped me express my amazement at the job of parenting and trying to parent as both father and mother to this little girl that had just lost her mom, and I believe that I grew as a person because of this enormous challenge in my life, and it opened me to the suffering of other people, certainly I hope including the suffering of veterans that came back with, you know, psychological and physical wounds of enormous proportions. And as they talked, I listened. And I felt very, very, very privileged to listen and to be able to help get their stories out there, and especially as they try to communicate the fact that war is the wrong way to go about dealing with the rest of the world. So I feel as though, as sad as it was to have lost my wife, I have to find the door that opened, and the door that opened was to be able to hear other people, and hear their suffering and hear their messages, and not look at it and not listen. I mean, listen with real empathy, I think. That is my hope, in any case, that I've been able to do that.
Well, I think you've done very well at it. But I think, and this is getting to the thing, you've just described it. I mean, you can have the physiological wound where you have the injury, you've got cut,
yeah,
where you're bleeding. That does heal.
Right.
The doctor can treat that, and that does heal.
Yeah.
But the spiritual wound, this moral, this ethical, this psychological wound,
yeah,
that so many vets have, and all of us have, and you and I have spent a lot of time together.
Yeah.
I mean, in-depth time together, not just in passing.
Right, exactly.
But that psychological wound, as we've talked to others and as you've written your columns, and I know you've had responses back that I've shared, we've had responses back to your columns that I've shared with you.
Right.
That psychological wound, that moral ethical wound, is far, far more devastating,
right,
than a wound that a doctor can heal. But somehow,
yeah,
the world misses that.
Right. There's no language for it, except maybe language that is, that is beginning to happen. I mean, some people now use the term moral injury to talk about those kind of wounds, as opposed to post-traumatic stress disorder. PTSD is a mental problem, and so you need a head doctor to help you fix it. But a moral injury is an injury to your conscience, and it's the injury of a citizen. And it takes it out of the realm of something that you fix, medically, and turns it into something that we all share. I mean, that there's it's a social wound. And if someone is suffering from a moral injury, he or she cannot remain isolated with that injury. It's the wound of a citizen, and to heal it means to heal society itself.
Denise, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
I mean, when treating the casualties on the front line, I mean, you treated the Vietnam vets coming back, and then you were on a front line medevac unit, and during our Desert Storm, I mean, you're literally on the Iraqi border. What did you see? What did you feel? What did you hear? I mean, you're obviously treating, the actual bullet wounds, the bombs, and all of those cuts, lacerations, everything under the sun. But you were also working with the psychological wounds, weren't you?
Not so much. I mean, we mainly had, we had the enemy prisoner of war transport, too. But we had our own over on 7th Corps area. That was our area. We were receiving patients from three Army hospitals. So we had a variety of illnesses, but really did not have that many transport of the psychological injuries at that point. It was, wartime injuries.
You and I have talked about it, and you've begun to see them and work with people all over the world.
Right.
You've done rescues yourself where they, supposedly people that are supposed to save the rescues failed and you had to go in and with a team and rescue?
Well, we talked about it quite a lot, Doug, because in the middle of the night, sometimes you got phone calls to assist because, you know, once we got them home and they were sick and not doing well physically, we did go through the time with our Gulf War vets of just wanting to give up and trying to respond to that need and get action from other states. I mean, you were in Chicago area or Champaign, down in Denver, and, you know, I get a vet in trouble and in Tennessee, Kentucky, or Alabama.
Yeah, we had to activate the 101st Airborne Chaplain in the middle of the night one time.
Right.
Wow.
Try to get them help and get somebody there and get them transported and get them seen. So that happens, and it's happening even more with our current post 9/11 vets. The suicide rate, I think, what, 22 a day now?
Wow.
And that's high level of suicide. Luckily, I think the Gulf War vets have kind of gained strength from their illness in a way of, I'm not going to let them win. I'm not going to take, you know, that route out. There was a big push with Vietnam vets to recognize that problem.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of taught us. I was Vietnam era, didn't serve in theater, but was taking care of them. I was getting training in the VA hospital. I was going to nursing school, and then I joined the military. I had time at Wilford Hall, and we still had, you know, the post-Vietnam vets coming in and needing care and assistance. But, you know, the emphasis now on suicide prevention, I mean, how many wars did we have to fight to even get a 800 phone number set up for them?
Wow.
You know, it wasn't set up until the post 9/11. And we've had that problem for years, just like the problem with homelessness. So I guess more attention is being paid to it. But Doug, you and I have even had guests on the program that people took their son in to get treatment and they knew they were in trouble and they got turned away. Or they were released too soon, and they went home and, you know, committed suicide. It's a huge problem, and luckily we have more people speaking up, more leaders in the military speaking up about that problem. But we haven't found the perfect solution to cut down that rate, that's for sure, if we're at 22 a day.
I think the frustration with the suicide and the PTSD and everything else, we know that, and we talked about PTSD here last week on the show, where we had a guest who was raised in the military and then went all this up through the Hurricane Katrina and everything. But that PTSD is a function not only of a psychological wound, but the PTSD is a physiological wound. And
right.
All of these toxins, as Denise, you were seeing this immediately, where you were seeing the aberrant behavior as a result of the toxic exposures on the front line.
To have friends turn on friends, you know, our own troops, and to hear what was going on other places, you know, a soldier share with me about that, that's not normal. That is not normal. And then, you know, it's continued sometimes, you know, since. We have trouble getting along with each other, and when we've got neurotoxin damage, from all the toxins that we had in the Gulf War, that's not going to help you function well. I mean, the neurocognitive function. One of the things I had done while on my trip was I got referred by two people. You know both of them, Doug, but Dr. Johnson and Dr. Ray.
Both incredible physicians, experts.
Right, that have dealt with environmental hazards. They referred me to a physician, not a physician, PhD. Her PhD is in psychology, but she's worked with environmentally damaged people for over 25 years. And she does the neuropsych evals. And so I went through, I got lucky. She had a cancellation, so I was able to get in while I was down there. And, I mean, she put me through 11 hours of neuropsych testing. Usually it's divided into two appointments, but, you know, I had the time, and she was there, and I was there, and I got the appointment. And it's things that, and I'm going to say to the Gulf War vets and to the post 9/11, if you have not gotten a neuropsych eval, a complete one, and a complete one's going to take, it's not the short ones, but the ones that throw every test on the book at you, and they, it looks at all the brain functioning. You know, it's all pencil and paper and going through things in an office setting, but it can show the damage in the different spheres of the brain.
Well, we also had the same thing where you and I went through the, you know, the Bob Haley variety MRIs and
right.
all of this where, you know, actually showed up the problems while they're doing the MRI at the same time you're doing this testing, and it's incredible what all of that great research is showing.
And to have people lose their careers, she knows I lost my career in nursing, and I knew there was hazards both ways for patients and for myself being in a hospital setting and teaching students and all that. But, you know, that's a tragedy, and that happens to veterans. You lose your ability to maintain your career. And that is a huge hit, a huge trauma to go through, much less having gone through the war. And, you know, I think about all the trying to keep them employed and the job opportunities and the programs that are being set up and the variety. And I wonder how long we're going to keep these people working and if they've gotten good neuropsych and good help to deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to do something about the toxins in our body.
Bob, I mean, you've been a journalist for, what, 40 years?
Yeah, since the 70s. that's 10 years now. No, I mean, yeah, a long time.
Well, what? Bob, you remember the Vietnam vets with their, I'm trying to remember what it was called, but I think it was Dewey Canyon. And Carrie was speaking out.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, that was the first Winter Soldier stuff
right.
going on then.
So that goes back in history. I don't know if it goes back further than Vietnam, but, you know,
a hearing, a Winter Soldier hearing in Detroit in, when was that, like 69 or 70 or something like that?
Yeah.
And, you know, it came from the Revolutionary War, who was it, Thomas Paine, that said, you know, the winter soldier, the summer patriot, you know. It's like the fair weather friend. The winter soldier that digs in the winter, that's the patriot. And so they took that name, the winter soldier, the ones that truly dug in and stood for, you know, reached for the best for their country through the darkness and so it was the Vietnam. Yeah, I mean, Carrie was one of the speakers at that first hearing way back in, you know, the late 60s, and then the Iraq.
In the last 6 months, I saw the replay of his testimony on the Hill.
Yeah,
and it's breathtaking.
From that time?
It's actually as pertinent today to hear that testimony
absolutely.
Today as any other time.
Absolutely, yeah.
How do you,
well,
Bob, how do you,
powerful.
What would you recommend, or how a journalist that's coming up, or what is studying journalism in the universities,
yeah,
or gets on a job at a paper or in a magazine, what advice can you give them? How do they get involved in this? What do they need to do? I mean,
okay.
And do you understand the question
yeah,
I'm asking?
Yeah, I think so. And that's a hard question because you have to learn. I mean, I actually teach a class at DePaul University up here in Chicago called Peace Journalism, and it deals with that question. The advice is hold on to your conscience. Hold on to what you believe in, and you know, and don't get cynical. Don't get cynical. Write about what matters to real people. Don't get caught in, well, we used to call it the Iron Triangle. It's the, you know, editor, reporter, and source. You know, and and we're writing for our sources, and that's where cynicism comes from, and you're writing about what matters to the powerful, and that's what happens to journalism and to journalists as they rise. You know, the higher they get, the more they surrender their autonomy to be themselves and to look for the real stories out there.
Well, you mentioned DePaul, and y'all had a conference up there within the year, I think, that Cy Hurst came and presented to.
Okay, right, yeah.
Yeah, we worked together. Denise and I both worked together with Cy.
Oh, really? How interesting.
He's a great example
of somebody that, does that. I mean, that, you know, of a journalist that goes for the deep story. I mean...
He wrote a book called Against All Enemies, and we were both involved in that book.
Okay. Oh,
and,
how interesting. Wow.
We had Denny Williams, as Doug mentioned, and we had David Parks down in Birmingham, Alabama.
Okay.
And then we had, I can't remember the guy from Dallas. My mind just blanks out occasionally.
Yeah, I know what you
we've
mean.
We've only had a handful.
Yeah, and obviously
really
we had...
covered the issue. And we had Gannett News, of course.
Okay.
That covered it.
But yeah,
it's a very small group of journalists that will write on all sides.
Right. Well, yeah, it takes a journalist that, excuse me, is able to stand on his or her own, and sometimes they're trapped. They're trapped in what their paper will let them do. But you have to do your best within the context in which you're writing, and keep. I mean, it's all stuff that everybody says. I mean, speak truth to power. It's easier said than done, because it might mean you lose your source. I don't know the alternative.
How do you go about? I mean, I understand parts of this, and Denise, because we're kind of sources, if more than anything. But how do you develop the information, gather the information? How do you verify information? I mean, just because one of us comes up and says something doesn't mean, unless we have the documentation. I mean, Denise and I, obviously, we can work with it because we're the documentation, because we're the direct people involved.
Right.
But how does a reporter go about gathering this information or developing the confidence in... that's necessary for somebody to talk to them?
Right. Well, that's an important and difficult question. And you can't take one person's word. It's got to be verified, in a number of ways. If the New York Times says it, but somebody else is saying it in a different context, and say Doug Rocky is also saying it, and you find something, I have to get it from a number of sources, and maybe people are saying close to the same thing, and I have to, so it's a combination of my instinct, what seems to make sense, plus what a number of people are saying. Especially if it's about harm being done, err on the side of caution. If people are starting to talk about birth defects and rising cancer rates because of pollution from the war effort in Iraq, and it's being said from a number of sources, it's time to start writing about that. And, you have to put it in the context of this person is saying it and that person is saying it, but it's not like you can, but it becomes cynical to say, you have to wait for absolute proof or something like that. In other words, when do you say smoking is harmful? There was opposition to that statement for decades, but at a certain point you say, yes, smoking is harmful. And at a certain point you say, yes, depleted uranium is harmful. I don't know if I'm answering you sufficiently or not. It's at a certain point you just have to go with what seems to be a likelihood, especially if it's a likelihood that there is harm occurring by something that we're doing or that we're doing to ourselves, and start writing about it and start writing about what people are saying. And and if there's people on the other side saying something, as well, I mean, the other thing to look at is who has the motive for saying what they're saying. If someone is hired to say depleted uranium is not the problem, or toxic burn pits are not a problem, but they're paid to say that harms their credibility. It's a process that requires continually being open to what people are saying. The report I recently wrote about on the sexual assault in the military, the Pentagon's report that said that in 2012 there were 26,000. Well, there's been a certain amount of criticism of that report, and so I'm in the process of investigating that criticism, I will continue to investigate it. I'm doing the best I can until I'm satisfied. Before I use that figure again, I'll go, well, let's investigate, the criticism of it. But the criticisms, sometimes are just meant to blow it off so that you forget about it. And, there's clearly an issue there. There's clearly a problem there. Whether the number is 26,000 or whether it's less or whether it's more, sometimes it's hard to know the exact truth. But so anyway, I don't know. That begins to get the answer of your serious and complicated question. How do you know the truth? It's
about personal growth and development. I mean, you and I have both, in our work together, we both changed and we've altered opinions and we've seen things and we've experienced things.
Right.
How does that come into a play as a journalist?
Everything I write, I try to be open to learning and growing. I hope that I stay open. Personal growth, I think, first of all, requires openness. If you are fixed in your opinions, if you're fixed in your certainties, I think you will stop growing as a person and as a, as a professional. Staying open, staying sensitive to, staying sensitive to the reality, to the effects, to the suffering of others, to that which affects other people, is very important. Rather than staying committed to an ideology, if you are just fixed and certain in your opinions and your ideology, I guess that's a recipe for not growing any further. And I hope that makes sense.
It's a continual growth process.
It's a continual growth process. The more you learn, the more you grow. And you learn by staying open and listening. Listening. Doing more listening than talking.
Well, we're getting down to the bottom of the hour. And I wanted to mention two more things real quick. before we go off air this week. We have Memorial Day, and I think that we've forgotten a very valuable thing, and that was our POWs from Vietnam. And they celebrated 40 years from the time they had their White House dinner out in California at the Nixon Library. Or was it Reagan? Anyway, it was on May 24th. Their guest speaker, their honored guest, as always, is Ross Perot.
He's a good friend of ours.
Oh, yes. Wow.
And he is, I don't think everybody can really recount everything they know that he's done for veterans. And, you know, he stood and made a difference with the POWs from Vietnam and has done things since with the Gulf War vets, the Iraqi vets. We need to compliment him for the role he's played for years. That was their, I think, their 40th anniversary from 1973 from the White House dinner they had when they came home in 1973. The other thing I wanted to mention, and it's to honor somebody that I believe we've both met, Doug, and it's from our UK vet, and Dr. Derek Hall died. And he had served and ended up retiring because of health. He had worked with the Lords and the ministry over there in England to get help for us. He was a medical officer from 69 to 98 when he had to retire due to illness, and he has died and passed away. So our UK vets are hurting from missing a bold leader that got involved and tried to make a difference.
Yeah, well, we're running out of time. Bob, can you come back on our show again?
Absolutely.
Denise, thank you again very much and everything else. Bob, continue on. You also have Voices of Peace Radio, correct?
Yes, Voices of Peace Radio. We've been sort of on a hiatus. We'll be back back in action this month talking about these kind of issues.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Bob. Thank you,
Denise.
And God bless America.
Very much. Thank you, Denise and John. Just a little.